What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Monday, July 1st. We had free agency kickoff yesterday at 6 p.m., and a lot of player movement is already underway. We've had a good amount of players signed, still a lot of players that are yet to be signed, so we're going to talk through the ones that have signed, some of the bigger ones who have not signed. But we also had some pretty big trades go down earlier this week and last week, so going to get to all of that. A lot to cover in this one. Even some of the smaller deals I'm not going to be able to get to just because of how much has gone on in the past week. But with that said, let's go ahead and get right into it. So I want to start off with probably the biggest news of the past couple days or the past week or so, and that is that Paul George has decided to move on from the Los Angeles Clippers and will be signing a four-year, $212 million max contract with the Philadelphia 76ers. So this has been rumored for quite a while now. The Sixers had been lining up their cap sheet to be able to have max contract space this summer, and Paul George has been the number one rumored target for them. And in addition to signing George, they did bring back Kelly Oubre on a two-year, $16 million deal to stay with the team. They agreed to a max rookie extension with Tyrese Maxey, and they also signed Andre Drummond and Eric Gordon to smaller deals as well. So they are loading up to improve this roster from what they had last year. And is Paul George making over $50 million at the age of 37 and 38 going to be ideal? Probably not. However, this is a no-brainer deal regardless, because the Sixers had no other move. They needed to add the best player they could, and Paul George was the best player they could add. And in order to get him, they were going to have to give him that fourth year. They were going to have to give him the max. And so I don't fault them at all, regardless of how bad this deal might look down the road. This was the no-brainer move because you have Joel Embiid in his prime, an MVP-level player, that you have to maximize that. And this was the best way to improve the team. So you make this deal 10 out of 10 times and worry about 38-year-old Paul George later. But for right now, Paul George is just a dream fit for this team. There's been a lot of different variations of the Sixers that we've seen next to Embiid. We saw him come into the league with Ben Simmons. That pairing lasted four seasons before Ben Simmons lost all of his confidence and basically forgot how to play basketball and eventually asked to be traded. He also had Jimmy Butler next to him for one season, though that was a midseason acquisition. They never really got to have a full chance to see what those two could do together before he departed for Miami. Then once Simmons became a lost cause and asked out, they were able to get James Harden to pair next to Embiid, which was a pretty nice pairing for a couple years. They looked really good at different moments throughout their tenure together, really good regular season team, but ultimately fell short in the postseason. Not a huge surprise given Harden's track record there. And so they were not able to get over the hump before there was a major contract dispute between Harden and Daryl Morey and the organization as a whole, which led to him wanting to be traded. So now they pair him with Paul George. This is the fourth different all-star pairing that we've had next to Embiid, excluding Tyrese Maxey, who did make the all-star team last year. But to me, this is the best fit of them all, especially when you take Maxey into consideration. Because Simmons, I mean, obviously he was a lost cause back then, but obviously his game hadn't really translated well to the postseason, became a bit of a liability offensively. Harden just has a terrible track record in the postseason in general, just came up small in the biggest moments, which is not what they needed next to Embiid, considering Embiid has done a little bit of the same throughout his career. And then Jimmy Butler, like I said, I mean, they were about as close as they could have been to making a deep run. They lost a game seven in the second round on the road on a buzzer beater. So they had a real chance to do something that year with him, but obviously didn't really get a second chance to run it back. And Paul George, to me, just, again, a dream fit for this team. He brings positional versatility. He brings elite shot making, elite shooting. He can play on ball. He can play off ball. He can run the offense when Embiid is not in the game. He can play perfectly alongside Embiid. He's got size. He plays both ways of the basketball, offense and defense. Like, he is just everything you could want. He's not a guy with a big ego out there. He's used to being the second fiddle as he was throughout his entire tenure with the Clippers, but he also can be the main guy, which we saw him do when they made the conference finals back in 2021 without Kawhi Leonard. So just the overall skill set that Paul George brings, the mentality in terms of just being okay as more of a complimentary star next to other stars that probably are better than him at this point. He's willing to acknowledge that, which a lot of these guys often aren't. And so I love the fit for the Sixers. I think next to Maxey, it also is a great fit just because of the size and defense that Paul George brings. He's going to take some pressure off of Maxey so he doesn't have to be the main ball handler all the time. And it's just a match made in heaven, genuinely. I do want to see how they fill out the rest of the roster, but they're off to a pretty good start. As I mentioned, they signed Eric Gordon, who's a good floor spacer, Andre Drummond, who's an elite rebounder and a decent backup after Embiid. They brought back Oubre, like I mentioned. They also drafted Jared McCain, who could be an impact player as soon as his rookie season. But they obviously need to add some more depth on the wing. They lost Nick Batum, who re-signed with the Clippers, actually, and then Kyle Lowry is a free agent as well. But look, the Sixers are in prime position to contend. They've got probably the best trio of players of any team in the entire league. They have an MVP level player in his prime in Joel Embiid, a guy who won MVP 2 years ago and was on track to win back to back last season before injuries derailed his season. We have Tyrese Maxey, a guy who had a career year last year. He not only won most improved player, but averaged a career high in points, assists, rebounds, everything across the board, as well as averaged a ridiculous 30 points on good shooting in the postseason. So he's proven to be not only a very good player in general, but a guy whose game does translate to the playoffs alongside Embiid and the rest of this group. And so now you bring in Paul George to that, a perennial all-star, a guy who got some All-NBA votes last year, who we've seen at different times throughout his career, has played in some really big games, whether it be back in Indiana when he was going against LeBron and the Heat, or just with the Clippers as well, like I said, when they went on their conference final run a few years back. So how far this team ends up going next year is going to come down what it seems to it always coming down with Philadelphia, which is health. I mean, if Embiid is compromised or if he misses time, then they're not going to have much of a shot to contend. If Paul George is compromised or misses time, they're not going to be much better than they were last year when they got bounced in the first round. I'm not as concerned about Maxey just because we haven't seen any health issues out of him, and he's younger, obviously, at this point in his career. But it's not a great injury track record for either of George or Embiid. I mean, in his time with the Clippers, Paul George only played above 60 games one single time, and it was just this past season. He also missed the entire postseason in 2023. He only played 31 games total in 2022. They missed the playoffs entirely because he also wasn't able to play in their play-in game that year. So he has been wildly injury prone, as has Embiid, for which we've obviously seen over the past couple years. So ultimately, it's going to come down to health. I'm not worried about the fit. I think Nick Nurse is one of the best coaches in the league. I think he's going to integrate George seamlessly to this group. And so it really is going to come down to health. Can they be healthy when it matters most at the end of the year? And it hasn't been a great bet for them in the past. So I'm not going to shoot them up to like the favorites in the East or anything like that. I think Boston is still the prohibitive favorite, regardless of anything that anyone in the Eastern Conference does at this point, just because of how dominant they looked last year. And then bringing everybody back, they are younger, they are less injury prone, they are deeper than any team in the East, despite maybe not having the best player in a lot of the series they might end up playing. But that didn't seem to matter this past season. So outside of Boston, I think the Sixers have a legitimate shot to the number two spot in the East in terms of just contending. I'm not even talking necessarily about record, but just chances to make the finals. I think Milwaukee should benefit greatly from an offseason in which they can like gain some actual continuity. They won't have another coaching change. They've got a full year of Dame in the offseason to just integrate him better into the group and what they're looking to do. Giannis will hopefully be healthy to start next season. I know he's going to play for the Olympics, so he should be good to go by the time the season starts. So I'm more optimistic about Milwaukee than maybe most going into next year, just based on all those things. And then the Knicks, obviously, I'll talk about their big move a little bit later in the episode, but they have reloaded as well and should be taken a little bit more seriously than maybe we should have taken them last year. So the East is a lot stronger at the top. And so given that we've got kind of four strong contenders in the conference, it's no bet that the Sixers will definitely get out of the second round again, something that they have failed to do in the Embiid era. However, like I said, this should give them their best shot. I think the 2019 team with Jimmy Butler was the best team we'd seen Embiid play on, but I think this team has a real chance to rival that, because that team, while they were very top-heavy with their starting lineup with Simmons, Butler, Embiid, Tobias Harris, and J.J. Redick, they were very thin behind those guys. They had a very bad bench. And also, I mean, it was midseason integrating Butler. Simmons was still kind of a shell of himself in the playoffs. And Tobias Harris is Tobias Harris. Plus, Embiid was younger back then. He's just better than what he was then now. And so a better Embiid with much better depth around these guys, a much better coach, in my opinion, than Nick Nurse, I think this is the best shot they've had. And so the pressure is going to be on them. I know they've got a theoretical four-year window with Paul George, because they just signed this contract with him for 4 years. So it's not like the pressure is majorly on them to win it this year or anything like that. But again, this is no more excuses for Joel Embiid. He's got the perfect running mate next to him alongside Maxey as well. They have the depth, or they're going to have the depth, just based on the cap space that they still have remaining and the moves they still can make. They still have some picks to move if they really want to. So they're going to have plenty good enough depth. They're going to have the star power they need. They've got a very good head coach. There will be no more excuses for Joel Embiid if he can't at least get to the conference finals. I don't think anyone would be upset if they lost to Boston in a hard-fought conference finals matchup, for example. It would be a good building block and stepping stone for them to eventually, hopefully, getting to the next level there. But again, no more excuses for Embiid, because he's got everything he needs to succeed. And at this point, he needs to stay healthy. He needs to play better in the postseason. And they've got a really good shot to be really, really good next season for a number of reasons. Taking a step back a little bit from the Sixers as a team, I just want to talk about how much of a win this is for Daryl Morey specifically, because he has received a lot of criticism over the past couple years since he got to Philadelphia about being patient and waiting on the Ben Simmons thing, which eventually paid off, because not only were they able to get rid of Simmons when it seemed like his value was very low, they were able to get, at the time, all NBA level player in James Harden in return, and gave up very little it back to Brooklyn in retrospect. So that was a huge win. Then we get to this Harden situation where basically he asks out, and it seems theoretically across the league there's very little market for him. Nobody really wants to get into the James Harden business. He's on the older side, about 35, 34-ish at this point. He wants more money. That's the whole reason that he didn't want to be with the Sixers anymore, because he took a pay cut, and then Morey decided not to give him that max that he was looking for the next year. So that looked like another situation where they were not going to be able to salvage it, really. And so they'd make the trade. He's patient again. It seems like it's kind of a underwhelming return. I mean, it was what, Robert Covington, Nick Batum, just some salary fillers along with a couple picks. And I said this at the time when I talked about that trade. I said this is an incomplete trade for the Sixers, and that we cannot fully judge it or grade it until we see what happens over the next couple months and into the offseason to see if they're able to take advantage of the cap space that they were trying to create. But now that we've seen that they got Paul George, it was absolutely worth it. I don't think they could have done a better job of salvaging the James Harden trade. I mean, they basically turned a distressed asset in Ben Simmons into James Harden. They turned another distressed asset in Harden into what is now basically Paul George. So they not only signed Paul George, but they also got two picks from the Clippers in that deal. Two picks that are going to look really, really valuable and juicy moving forward, just given that the Clippers have moved on from Paul George and they should theoretically take a step back, and they're still building around a 33-year-old Kawhi Leonard. So Morey deserves so much credit, because we see teams do this all the time where they try to set themselves up to sign guys and then they don't end up getting to sign those players, and then it looks questionable in retrospect. And so they were able to get it done. It's a huge win for Morey and the Sixers, and just credit to them for staying patient, turning these assets into just upgrades basically every single time. And now they're in prime position to contend, or at least the best chance that they have to contend that they've had in the Embiid era, in my opinion. On the Clippers side of this, this is a real head-scratching move for them in my decision. And it's not because I think that Paul George is going to be worth paying $50 million at age 38. It's probably going to be a really ugly contract towards the end of it. And so in a vacuum, I could understand why you'd say, okay, we want to not give him that fourth year. We don't want to give him the max just because of where the NBA is heading with the new CBA and all the rules regarding the first and second apron, et cetera. I get that. But I genuinely cannot wrap my head around the decision-making process for the Clippers regarding this whole situation, because they went all in when they decided to trade for Paul George as a package deal to acquire Kawhi Leonard 5 years ago. And at the time, that's a trade and a move that any team would have made. Kawhi Leonard at the time was basically a top three, top two, maybe even top one player in the league. Paul George was a back end of a top 10 type player as well. So it was a no-brainer move in the grand scheme of things to do that. And they've continued to build around this team and continue to add pieces around them over the years. And they doubled down on this group when they acquired James Harden, because you don't acquire James Harden if you're not going for it. You don't acquire James Harden at age 34 unless you're trying to go all in to win a championship. And so they did that. Then this past season, they give Kawhi Leonard a 3-year near max extension. So he's 33 right now. That'll get him through age 36. Despite him being so injury prone over the years, they decide to triple down by extending him and basically playing him through the rest of his back end of his prime, if you even want to say he's still in his prime. Then they quadruple down by then re-signing Harden. So they traded the picks for him. They re-sign him to $35-plus million this offseason as well. And so all of these moves make sense if you're then going to keep Paul George, to say, okay, we're doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on this core. We believe that with the high-end talent of Harden, Paul George, and Kawhi Leonard, we have a chance to win a championship. Whether that's true or not, that's a different discussion. But at least with that group and the supporting pieces they have around them, with Ty Lue at the helm, you could talk yourself into it. You could say, hey, we've been really close in the past. Injuries have derailed us, but when we've been healthy, we're as good as any team in the West. And a lot of people thought they were one of the best teams in the West next to Denver last season for the majority of the year, until again Kawhi got hurt towards the end of the year. So there's a reasonable thought process to say that they were in contending territory with that group. But to give up valuable picks for Harden and re-sign him for $70 million, and then to extend Kawhi Leonard at $150 million over 3 years, to do all of that just to let Paul George walk makes no sense to me. It's just you either have to continue to pursue being as good as you can with the talent you have, or you've got to jump ship. And they're doing what I would never recommend, which is straddling in the middle. There's no question that they're a worse team without Paul George, and that the Clippers have almost no chance to contend without him next year. No, regardless of who they add, they could add DeMar DeRozan, whatever they want to do. They're not going to be good enough to contend next year. With Paul George, you could say, okay, well, it's unlikely, but maybe if things break their way. No, without Paul George, they have no chance. They just don't have enough in the Western Conference. And so to basically willingly admit now that you don't have enough, go into the season as basically a non-contender, but still give Kawhi the extension, still trade for James Harden and re-sign him, like, it just doesn't make sense to me. They need to pick a path. And to me, they should have just kept Paul George, because the blow it up path, while I would understand it, they owe so many picks to other teams at this point. They still owe 2 picks to the Thunder, I believe, and 2 picks to the Sixers. So they don't own the next 4 years of their own draft equity. So I understand not wanting to blow it up, because if you're bad, then those picks just go to another team. So there's no incentive to tank. So I get it. So I understand extending Kawhi Leonard. I understand trading for James Harden. I understand re-signing James Harden. I defended all of those moves, and I still think they were the right moves given their situation. So then why do you now decide you don't want to pay Paul George? It just makes no sense to double down, triple down, just to back out of the Paul George business. It just, I don't get it. I genuinely don't get it. Maybe they're scared of the second apron and they're what is entailed with that, with the repeat offender, if their future draft picks getting moved to the back of the first round, whatever it may be. But I just, you either should blow it up and let James Harden walk and trade Kawhi Leonard, or you got to bring back Paul George. So this deal makes no sense to me, the fact that they let him walk, and especially if you could have signed and traded him to Golden State. Golden State made an offer. I think it was reported to be like Wiggins, Kuminga, Chris Paul, Moody, and a first-round pick or something like that. Is that an amazing haul? Not really, but it's at least you're recouping some of your value. It's not a terrible trade because you could have just cut Chris Paul or had him for one more year before he eventually leaves, whatever, retires. Then you would get a player in Kuminga that showed a lot of promise last year. You get another first-round pick. Moody could potentially be a decent player if given more opportunity. And the Wiggins contract isn't great, but it's not absolutely killer. And so to just decline that, when that was the only other offer that you had, aside from just letting him walk for nothing, again, just poor asset management and just complete lack of direction for this team. And to me, they are a significantly worse team than they were last year. And I don't think I would have had them close to contending even with Paul George, just because of their injury history and the bad luck we've seen this team had in the past. But without Paul George, they won't sniff a top four seed. I think they're a playing team at best. And if Kawhi Leonard misses 25 games, I don't think they'll make the playoffs, because their margin for error is almost zero now. They just added Nick Batum. They might try to add somebody else. Like, it doesn't matter who else they get, even if they get a DeRozan. I'm just, without Paul George as insurance for Kawhi getting hurt, this team just is not going to have enough. And because of how stacked the West is, like, him missing 20 games could be them falling to like the 11 or 12 seed legitimately. It's that detrimental with how deep the West is and just the lack of talent that they have now. So I don't understand this for the Clippers at all. I think this is a huge loss, huge mistake, poor asset management, and they needed to pick a direction, and instead they kind of stuck themselves right in the middle, and they're going to be mediocre for the next three-ish years, however long they continue to employ James Harden and Kawhi Leonard. Okay, so probably the next biggest move we've had over the past week was the Mikal Bridges trade to the New York Knicks, as well as them re-signing OG Anunoby. So in this deal, the Knicks received Mikal Bridges and a second-round pick, and the Nets got in return Bojan Bogdanovic's expiring contract, unprotected picks from New York in 2025, 2027, 2029, and 2031, as well as an unprotected pick swap in 2028 from the Knicks and a top four protected pick in 2025 that comes from the Bucks, and then one more second round pick as well. So this was a haul, and this one shocked me because I was skeptical that the Nets were going to move Bridges just given their situation with their own picks, but obviously this deal coincided with the deal they made with Houston to get those picks back, so it makes more sense. But from the New York side of things, there's really two lenses to view this trade. One is in a vacuum, and one, the other one is with context. So in a vacuum, this is a massive overpay, a massive, massive overpay. I don't think we have seen a trade that involved five first-round picks going to another team other than the Paul George trade from OKC. And I don't mean picks and swaps. I'm talking about just picks, like legitimate single picks going out as an asset, not the right to swap. There was five first-round picks that went from the Knicks to the Nets here. The Clippers also sent five first-round picks to OKC for Paul George, coincidentally. We were just talking about that. But at least Paul George was coming off a year in which he had been top three in the MVP. Most people had him as a top 10 player at the time, multi-time All-NBA player, 9 All-Star appearances at this point in his career. And Mikal Bridges has 0 All-Star appearances to his name, and I highly doubt he ever will get one. He's 27 at this point, and he's turning 28 into next season. And he is a very, very good player. I think he is a top 40-ish player in the league, but do you trade 5 first-round picks for the 40th best player in the league? It's a really tough thing to talk yourself into. And so I'm sure that the Nets were basically like, we are not dealing him unless we're blown away. And so the Knicks said, fine, we'll blow you away. They had the picks to deal him. But in a vacuum, this is a massive overpay. There's really no way around it. Trading 5 first round picks for a non all-star is just really difficult to talk yourself into. And I know Knicks fans won't like this comparison, but this trade is eerily reminiscent of the Rudy Gobert trade. And I know the reputations around these two players is wildly different. Everybody loves Mikal Bridges. Everyone thinks he's a plug-and-play guy, can fit in on any team, the type of skill set every team wants, a 3-and-D guy, a guy that can create a shot a little bit, great shooter, great point-of-attack defender, et cetera, et cetera. And Rudy Gobert doesn't get the same sort of love. A lot of people think he's overrated. They think his offensive limitations are crippling to a team. They think that his defense gets neutralized in the postseason, and a lot of those things might be true. However, Rudy Gobert is a 4-time defensive player of the year at this point in his career. He's made 3 all-star teams, 4 all-NBA teams. I mean, the guy is going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, regardless of what you think of him. He just is. I hate to break it to you. And so the Wolves were destroyed by the media when they traded for Gobert because people thought it was a massive overpay. And of course, there were more players involved in the Gobert trade. So it was ultimately more in totality that they gave up. I know the Knicks gave up more picks, but Bojan Bogdanović as the only player in the deal is massively different than when the Wolves traded like Jared Vanderbilt and Malik Beasley and Walker Kessler and everybody else that was involved in that deal. Obviously, that was more equity in players also sent out. But the point is, both of these moves are very similar. They were the highest of high-level role players that you could have. A role player that's so good that almost borderline is an all-star, sent out for a haul back in return of picks, and then in the case of the Wolves, players as well. And so in a vacuum, it's a very similar deal. The reputations of the players are different, and the maybe only different factor is that Gobert's on a max-level deal. Bridges maybe has the most team-friendly contract in the entire NBA. But again, you're trading for him. You're going to have to pay him. He's going to get close to a max when he ultimately does re-sign. So that is kind of a moot point, in my opinion. But again, in a vacuum, it's a massive overpay. If reputation of players or circumstances were a little bit different, this might be viewed as one of the biggest overpays in NBA history. And I'm not sure it's not. I think it's up there, seriously. However, if you look at this with context, it does suddenly it is massively more acceptable of a trade. And are the New York Knicks a better team than they were before this trade? Absolutely. Unequivocally, it's not even close. They are a significantly better team than they were before they made this deal. Because Mikal Bridges, aside from the fact that he went to college with 3 of the Knicks' best players and obviously is very close friends with them. And so you'd think chemistry, it'll be a perfect fit on across the board. But chemistry aside, skill set, as I said, he is a plug-and-play guy. He will fit in on any team. And the pairing of Mikal Bridges and OG Anunoby on the wing is going to be one of the deadliest combinations of perimeter defenders that we've seen like in a really long time, if not ever. It sounds crazy to say, but OG Anunoby is a spectacular all-defensive level defender, and Mikal Bridges is as well, and was even 2nd in Defensive Player of the Year award just a couple years ago. So these guys are devastating defensively. They both are phenomenal three-point shooters, but Bridges brings so much more than that as well. He is a very underrated passer, a very good connector within the offense. He is much improved as a guy that can put the ball on the floor. He's got a very nice little mid-range shot. He can get the basket a little bit. And so the shot creation ability and playmaking that he was able to lean into in Brooklyn should massively help him now that he's going to be back in more of a complementary role. He's probably going to be somewhere in between where he was in Brooklyn and Phoenix. Phoenix, he had much more of a marginalized role. But I think on New York, he's going to be a top 2 or 3 option on the team, probably the 3rd option. But he's just a much better player than he was back in Phoenix at this point, but just particularly offensively. And so, of course, this is a dream fit for them. He's just exactly what any team would want. He's going to take so much pressure off the other guys. I mean, this is like, if you just look at the pecking order of the team now, Josh Hart is now a bench player. Dante DiVincenzo is now a bench player. Like, those two guys, with Randall coming back and adding in Bridges, now put together one of the best bench units in the entire NBA. Those guys were playing like 40 minutes per game for this team in the postseason last year. So the fact that they now become a luxury rather than a requirement for this team to be competent like they were in the postseason is just massive for them. And just they desperately needed more guys that can create in the half court. They need more guys that can take the pressure off of Brunson, take the pressure off of Randall, more guys that can put the ball on the floor, that can go score in the isolation. And he does just that, but he does it without bogging down the offense. He can also be a guy that chills in the corner and that just plays within the flow of the offense. So he's just a dream fit for this team in terms of what they want to do. He fits it. Tibbs is going to love him. The guy doesn't miss any games. I think he's played every single game of his entire career to start his career. And so Tibbs is probably going to continue to play him into the ground like he has with other guys, but I think he's built for it. Unlike some of the other players, like Anunoby, for example, very injury prone guy. And they re-signed him for about $42 million a year, which seems like a lot of money, but it was a move they had to make because you don't trade for Bridges just to lose Anunoby. But this is insurance for Anunoby because we know what he brings to the table defensively, but Bridges is just as good on that end of the court and even better offensively. And so those guys flanking out on the wing next to Brunson running the show offensively, they're going to be so good defensively that they'll be able to hide some of the deficiencies that Brunson has there. And there's so much to like about this team in terms of their depth and their high level players that they have. Like, they probably only have one true consistent all-star all-NBA level player in Brunson, but they've got probably six guys that are in the top 100 in the NBA or something like that between Brunson, DiVincenzo, Hart, Bridges, Anunoby, Randall, even like Mitchell Robinson is a really nice player when he is healthy, especially on the defensive end of the court and as a rim runner. So the Knicks should be really good next year, even better than they were last year. We knew they were going to be better once they got Randall back and just actually if they put a healthy season together, because last year they were really banked up, especially in the postseason. But adding Bridges to this group, he's on the same timeline as the rest of their guys. They've got a 3 to 4 year window here with this group. But the question then becomes, can they contend? Because this is an all-in move for them. I know they had a lot of picks to trade, and they didn't technically trade all of them, but they did trade all of their own available picks to trade. So they don't have any more picks that they own that they could trade, but they have some picks from other teams. But it's rather deceiving. They technically have two other first round picks, one they acquired from the Pistons, one from the Wizards. But if you actually look at the protections on these, they're really not valuable assets, and they may not even be first round picks. One of the picks is the 2025 Pistons pick that is lottery protected for this coming season. If it doesn't convey, then it becomes top 12 protected in 2026. If it doesn't convey then it is top 10 protected in 2027. And if it doesn't convey then it becomes a second round pick. So you'd have to say that the Pistons are going to make the playoffs essentially in the next couple years for that to convey, which given how bad they were last year and the state of the league, I'm not sure that's going to happen. So that pick might not even be a first round pick. The other pick that they own is the 2025 Wizards pick that is top 11 protected. That is certainly not conveying next year. And if it doesn't, then it becomes a 2026 top 9 protected pick, which I do not think that's going to convey either, which then it becomes a second round pick. So they really have no first-round picks to trade anymore because the only two picks that they still own are picks that likely will not convey and will eventually turn into second-round picks. So it's not like they have no assets. They still have a lot of second-round picks they can deal. Those picks are still tradable if they really wanted to. They have some swaps they can still trade. And, of course, they have movable contracts. I mean, DiVincenzo's on a super team-friendly deal. Josh Hart's on a totally fine deal as well. And there were rumors that Mitchell Robinson was being shopped earlier in the offseason as well. So the point is, it's not like they don't have any moves they could make, but they're super limited. Like, there were a lot of talks about, like, if Embiid eventually wanted out or Giannis eventually wanted out, the Knicks would be in prime position. Like, those are no longer plausible for this team. They cannot make trades for that level of player because they just don't have the draft capital to pull it off. However, the reason I think this is a defendable move for them is because I don't know if those guys are ever going to be available. And the reason for the Knicks to have all these picks was to trade for an eventual star level player. That player probably was never going to be available, at least not in the time frame that lined up with what they're trying to do right now. And so Bridges made the most sense to add to this group. But this is the group. this is the group that they need to win with, because like I said, they're not going to have any cap space to sign anybody in the next 3 to 5 years. They have no draft capital to trade either. And so they are all in on this Villanova group with Brunson and Bridges and Randall and Anobi and DiVincenzo and Hart and everybody else. And so they need to legitimately contend if this is going to be worth it, because if they don't, then this is going to go down as a really bad trade, because it's just so many picks to add to a group that if they don't ever make a conference finals or anything like that, it's not majorly different than what the Clippers did for Paul George or what the Nets did for James Harden. Like, they gave up all these picks and never were able to really get over the hump with it. And so we'll see if they can do it. I think that they are much improved, as I said. They really need to get another center, in my opinion. Hartenstein left, which I'll talk about that addition to the Thunder a little bit later. But all they have is Mitchell Robinson now, who is probably one of the most injury-prone players in the entire NBA. He's averaged just 53 games played over the last 4 years, has played over 60 just once in that span. He has 2 seasons where he played only 31 games. He was hurt in the playoffs this past season as well. Like, the guy is just a walking injury waiting to happen. And so they cannot rely on him as their only like viable starting level center. They obviously need to add a backup to him, but I think they need to add someone who's not just like a replacement level backup. I think they need to basically have a second starter like they did with Hartenstein. That's why that combo worked so well, because they were both good enough to start. And so there was no drop off when one came out of the game. But at the same time, it was insurance for Robinson when he did eventually get hurt, and he inevitably likely will next year as well. So they really need a big man, because you're going to have to go through Giannis. You're going to have to go through Embiid. Like, they're going to need bodies to throw at these bigger star players in the East. And so Robinson's not going to be good enough on his own, because he's probably not going to be available. So they really need to add somebody there. But other than that, this is a pretty complete roster, and they're going to win on depth and on defense and on playing hard like they did last year. But they'll have much more star power with Randall coming back and Bridges coming in. Not true, true star power level players, but a lot more than what they had last year. And they should be even better defensively with Bridges in the fold now. So I am certainly not going to pick them to beat Boston. I still think they are head and shoulders above New York and anybody else in the East right now. But if you're a Knicks fan, you have to feel pretty confident that you've at least got a shot against anybody else. I probably would have had Milwaukee comfortably above the Knicks before this trade. I would have had the Sixers with Paul George comfortably above the Knicks before this trade. But with this trade, I think they're at least in the discussion with that group. I think that if you could guarantee 100% health for everybody in the East, so that means the Sixers, the Bucks, Celtics, Knicks as the top four contenders, I think I would have the Knicks fourth in that group. But the Sixers and the Bucks have significantly more injury risk, given that they just have older players. Giannis and Embiid are two players that both have consistently been banged up in the postseason throughout their career. Then you throw in Paul George and Damian Lillard, two other guys that are into their mid-30s that both have suffered a lot of injuries in the recent years of their career as well. So given that, I think that evens the playing field for New York a bit, because I know the Knicks were really injured last year, but they've got more players that are typically more durable. They have more younger players, and they're deeper as well. So they can overcome injuries a little bit better than those two other teams can. So I think ultimately those three teams are going to battle it out for who can dethrone Boston. I think they're all relatively in the same level. Like I said, I would pick the Sixers or the Bucks as the better teams in a vacuum if fully healthy, just because I think they've got more star power, more experience, and I just trust a lot of their guys more than I do the Knicks in the postseason. However, with their injury track records, I think the Knicks are in prime position to take advantage of that. I think if the Bucks or Sixers have any of their key guys miss time in the postseason, then I would pick the Knicks to beat either of them at that point. So I think they should be at least trying to make the conference finals. Another second round exit would be pretty disappointing given the investment they made and the fact that they've made the second round 2 years in a row at this point. But obviously there's four teams in the East that think they can make the finals, and only two of them are going to make the conference finals. So there's a very real chance the Knicks still get bounced second round, but there's a really real chance that they could beat Milwaukee or they could beat Philadelphia. Or if they face the Celtics and the Knicks are fully healthy and Porzingis is out or something like that, it's not crazy that they could conceivably knock Boston off if Boston had injuries, for example. So to me, the East is really going to come down to health, who's healthy at the end of the season. But I think the Knicks are probably the most likely team to be healthy at the end of the year. Anunoby is really the only guy in their rotation, and outside of Robinson, who I think they would get insurance for, that is an injury-prone guy. But again, it's really hard to say. I think the Knicks are right there with those teams in the East, a step behind Boston, very clearly in my opinion. But if they run into some luck with Milwaukee or Philadelphia, I think that they could beat either of those teams. On the Nets side of this trade, this is a home run for them. I mentioned how much of a haul they got back with all those picks. That is just, you couldn't ask for more in return for a guy like Bridges. And then when you compound that with all the picks they got from Phoenix, just in terms of in totality what they got for dealing Kevin Durant, and it is a massive haul. I mean, they got, I think, 9 first-round picks and 4 swaps or something like that in totality, along with Cam Johnson and Jay Crowder, who they then turned into like 5 second-round picks or something like that. So they absolutely reloaded their draft capital in a way that I don't think we really could have expected. But the one thing that makes this trade so great is the other trade they made with Houston, because the reason I didn't really believe that Bridges was necessarily going to be dealt this offseason is because the Nets don't, or at least didn't have their pick next season. That was to Houston unprotected. So there was no incentive for them to tank, no incentive for them to bottom out, because if they end up with the number one pick, they're just going to send that to the Rockets next year. So I thought they would try to be competent or at least somewhat competitive so that it's not quite as brutal if they do have to hand that pick over to Houston. But they made a second deal with Houston where basically they get back their 2025 pick. They also get their 2026 pick back. And the Rockets get the Suns' 2027 pick, as well as the more favorable of the Mavericks or Suns' first-round pick in 2029. And they get 2 swaps, one in 2025 and then another in 2029. So ultimately, they're turning 2 picks into 2 picks and 2 swaps. So in a vacuum, it's good asset management from the Rockets. But I'll get to them in a second. But this trade is what made this so doable for the Nets, because now they have their 2025 pick back and they can be the worst team in the league, and they probably will be. Their roster is looking sad right now. It's Cam Johnson, Cam Thomas, and a bunch of nobodies. So I expect them to be one of the absolute worst teams in the league this next season, and they'll have a really good chance at getting the top pick in one of the best drafts we've had in a while. 2025 is supposed to be a very, very good draft with Cooper Flagg at the top, Ace Bailey, Dylan Harper, to name just a few of the top prospects that the Nets will have a really good chance of getting. And so I saw a lot of people saying, why would the Rockets do this with Brooklyn? Well, I don't think the Nets would have made the Bridges trade if the Rockets didn't agree to this. I think this was a contingency trade where, okay, if the Rockets agree to this, then we will do the Bridges trade. But they were not going to do it unless they got their pick back, but they were able to pull it off, which makes sense. So for me, this is a massive win for the Nets. They should just look to rebuild, recoup. They recouped all of what they could have for Kevin Durant and James Harden and everybody else that they lost. And now they can essentially just tank next season, hope to get a top pick, and just reset with some more young guys moving forward. On the Rockets side of this, I get why they did it, kind of, in the sense of they traded 2 picks for 4. But to me, that 2025 Brooklyn pick was so much more valuable than anything that they got back from the Suns pick. So I don't really get it. I guess, to my point earlier, maybe the Nets said, hey, if you don't do this deal with us, then we're not doing the Bridges deal, and that 2025 pick's going to be like the 9th, 10th pick anyway, so you might as well just get the additional assets. That's very possible. If that's the case, then I kind of get why the Rockets did it. But if that was not the case, I really don't understand this from their perspective, because that 2025 Nets pick is one of the top assets in the entire league right now. Like, the Suns' 2029 pick could be super valuable. Same with the Mavs, if like Luka left, for example. But the 2025 Suns pick is not going to be a good pick. I mean, the Suns, unless they have major injuries, they're going to make the playoffs next season, you'd think, which would put them probably at worst in like the 17-18 range, probably higher than that. They were 22nd this year. I'd assume they'll be similarly in that range. So that's not some massive asset they're getting back. The 2027 Suns pick, yeah, maybe it's a little better. But again, unless Booker asks out, then they're never going to be a bottom five team, regardless of what people think of them right now as a contender. Like, if Devin Booker's on the roster, you'd have to think they're at least going to be in the play-in discussion, which, again, makes that pick not overly, overly valuable. So, I don't know. I thought the Nets picks are a lot more valuable just because their roster is really not a good roster. And the Suns could lose Kevin Durant next year, but they're going to have Bradley Beal because of his horrible contract, and Booker probably is going to stay around. We haven't seen any real things to say that he's going to want out anytime soon. So, with those two guys, plus an owner that's willing to spend, I can't see them falling into totally like tank area in the next 3 years or anything like that. Another big trade that happened over the weekend was DeJounte Murray getting sent to the Pelicans in exchange for Larry Nance Jr., Dyson Daniels, a 2025 first round pick from the Lakers, and a 2027 first round pick from either the Bucks or Pelicans, which will be because they have swap rights, so it could be either of those teams, depending on who has the better pick. So I thought this was a really good deal for New Orleans just because I thought it was really solid value. I mean, I don't think they gave up a ton. They kept all of their own future firsts. I mean, the two picks that they're giving up are picks from other teams. So it's not like they're mortgaging their future in any way like that if they end up not being super good down the road. And only two firsts and some rotation pieces. I mean, I do like Dyson Daniels as a player personally. I think he could turn into a really nice two-way player, especially if he develops a little bit more consistent of a jump shot. But it's if Murray's replacing him in the rotation, they're really not losing much in terms of their top seven or eight guys, really just losing Larry Nance, which he's a nice rotation piece, but he's replaceable. And so they still have plenty of picks and assets moving forward if they do want to make additional deals. So I just thought it was a really good value pickup. I mean, DeJounte Murray is not a perfect player by any means, but he still showed last year when Trae Young was out that he can be a really good, especially offensive player. I mean, he averaged 22.5 last year, 6 assists, 5 rebounds, shot 46% from the field, 36% from 3. So still a really nice piece. He's made one all-star game in his career. Is he a true all-star level player? Probably not, but he's a significant upgrade of what New Orleans had in terms of ball handlers over the last few years. This can let CJ McCollum switch more into a two-guard role, which to me is his more natural position. He's been kind of forced to play point guard for this team, which to me that's kind of a role that he shouldn't be playing. I still think he can be a really nice, valuable piece to a team, but to me he's better as an off guard, doing more catch and shoot stuff. He can do some shot creation, but obviously I don't see him as a guy that's running an offense, at least not as well as a guy like DeJounte Murray can. A little bit more of a true point guard, though not necessarily a true point guard himself, but it's a dime breed, and so Murray is plenty good enough as a lead guard. So now New Orleans has a really, really impressive top four in Zion Williamson, Brandon Ingram, CJ McCollum, and DeJounte Murray. And two other really, really good wing rotation pieces in Herb Jones and Trey Murphy, neither of which are probably ever going to be all-star level players, but both very, very good players. And outside of McCollum, all of those guys are 28 or younger. And this is a team that won 49 games last year. So there is a lot to like about New Orleans. I still think they need to make a couple more additions. They're really hurting in terms of their front court rotation because Jonas Valanciunas left for Washington as a free agent already, and they really don't have any other centers on the roster with Larry Nance being a part of this deal. But I expect them to add somebody, whether that be just a smaller piece signing in free agency or a bigger piece like trading for a Jared Allen, for example. But there's also been a lot of rumors around Brandon Ingram being dealt, and it doesn't seem like he's in their future. He's got 1 year left on a deal at $36 million, but it doesn't sound like they want to pay him the max contract that he could be due next year. And so we'll see what this roster ultimately ends up looking like, but obviously they're much improved. I mean, DeJounte Murray is a huge upgrade from Dyson Daniels, even if it's at the expense of Larry Nance. And so, unfortunately, I still do have my concerns. I think that they have a lot of guys that need the ball in their hand to succeed. DeJounte Murray, we just saw with Trae Young, not a great off-ball player. It was a clunky fit next to a guy like Trae who also needed the ball to be successful. And Murray is not a very good three-point shooter throughout his career, only 34.5%. He's only shot above 35% once in the last five seasons. So not a particularly good spot-up shooter, a guy who does most of his scoring at the basket and in the mid-range, and does a lot of his scoring in the isolation as well. So I worry a little bit about if there's too many mouths to feed with a guy like Murray, because we just saw that be an issue in Atlanta, even with just one other major mouth to feed. Then Brandon Ingram, as I said, he might be dealt, but if he's not, I really like Brandon Ingram, but again, he's a guy that kind of needs the ball in his hands more. We saw him struggle just last season with guys like Trey Murphy starting to break out. Zion finally had more of a full, healthy season. CJ McCollum consistently in the fold. Like, as they had more guys that needed the ball, Ingram looked a little less into the offense. And he is not a bad three-point shooter. I mean, 36% last year, 39% the year before, 36% for his career. But he's a low-volume guy. I mean, just the last three seasons, he's averaged only four attempts per game, basically, from outside. So that's pretty low volume for a guy of his usage and a guy that has the ball in the perimeter. And his scoring was the lowest it's been since he was with the Lakers last year. And he looked like kind of the odd man out a little bit offensively, despite putting up decent numbers, 21 points a game, almost six assists, five rebounds. So him with Murray, with Zion, who is the team's best player, and he obviously is at the best with the ball in his hands. They've even had him running some point guard at times for this team. And then that's not even to mention CJ McCollum and a guy like Trey Murphy, who can play predominantly off ball, but still a guy you want getting shots. So they just got a lot of guys that I think need the ball in their hands to be the best version of themselves. Which is why trading Ingram for a big guy like Jared Allen could make some sense. I don't know if Cleveland is really looking to move any of their guys, but that's just an example. So with that said, and just given the fact that they still have some pieces they need to add, and most importantly, the fact that the West is just stacked. It's stacked in the West. I can't really say that I think this is a major needle mover for New Orleans. I think I had them in the back end of the playoffs before this trade, and I think I still kind of have them in the back end of the playoffs. I wouldn't be shocked if they got a 5 or 6 seed. I mean, they were very close to getting a 6 seed just last season. But again, it's just, do I think they're going to beat Denver? No. Do I think they're going to beat Oklahoma City? No. Do I think that they are going to beat Minnesota? No. And so I'm not certain this makes them a team that wins a first-round series next year, just because it's a product of the West being so stacked, and it's not their fault, and I understand why they're going for it, because, again, very good value trade for them, and Zion looked like a true superstar towards the end of last season, so it makes sense. I'm not faulting them. I think this is a good move because of how little they gave up. It's low risk. Murray is on an extremely team-friendly contract, so I don't say this negatively towards, like, I don't know why they made this move or anything like that. I think this is a smart move, and I would have made it. But the point is, I'm more saying I think they need to make more moves if they want to truly get over the hump, because I still think that they're a clear step behind the top 3 to 4 to 5 teams in the West. And so they might need to kind of move some of the pieces around of this roster to make them fit together a little bit more in order to actually maximize what they can be. On the Hawks side of things, I know it's been rumored for a while that either Trey or DeJounte or maybe both were going to get moved. I think they made the clear-cut right decision to keep Trey and trade Murray. I know I've heard a lot of big media people say that they would prefer to trade Trey and keep Murray, but I am far on the other side of that boat. I think that keeping Trey was a no-brainer. I know he doesn't have the best reputation across the league. I know he probably doesn't have great value right now, and I know that he's a polarizing player, to say the least. But the guy is only 25 years old. He's made 3 all-star teams. He's made an all-NBA team. He carried a very subpar roster to a Eastern Conference Finals. Although it might have been a fluke, we've at least seen what he's capable of. I mean, the guy averaged 26-11 last season, shot 38% from 3 on 9 attempts per game. Like, he is, to me, a bona fide star. You don't want to call him a superstar, that's fine. He's maybe not a consistent all-NBA guy. He might be difficult to play with. All these things can be true. But to me, I just think replicating his talent is, like, impossible. and the Spurs own the Hawks pick next year. So trading both or being a worse version of what you could be is not a viable option for Atlanta. Trading both is just not something they could do. And trading Trey and keeping Murray is going to make them a worse team than the other way around, in my opinion. So to me, you still have to try to be competitive. You still have to try to make the playoffs. I don't think the Hawks are majorly far off from making the postseason. I know they had a disappointing year last year, but Trey missed almost 30 games, and him and Murray together just wasn't a very good fit. They had a minus 6.3 net rating last season when they played together on the court, and they were a plus 3.1 with just Trey on the court and a plus 0.8 with just Murray on the court. So clearly them together didn't work, and I think that's part of why they were so clunky last season and not very good. And so they obviously had to trade one of them. But I think Trey, I like a lot of the pieces they still have on the roster. I'm a big Jalen Johnson fan. I think Okongwu is underutilized and still could be a really solid center in this league. Clint Capella is still a decent rim-running big that they could either trade or keep. Bogdanovich had a really strong year last year. They have some pieces. It's not like they got nothing. They just drafted Zachary Risacher. I'm not the biggest fan of him, but we will see what he turns into. But the point is, I never understood why you would trade a 25-year-old player that is the face of your franchise, averaging 26-11, that's taking you to conference finals just because he didn't fit with another guy. And it sounds like the market for him wasn't great, so trading him for undervalue was just going to be a disaster to me. And look, he's still young. You can still try to build around Trey. So I think this was the right move. I think they had to ship out Murray. They got decent value, get some picks back, get a nice player in Dyson Daniels that can fit your timeline with some of the younger guys you have and is a good defensive player. Like, they should be much improved defensively, I would think. And just credit to Atlanta for taking the loss on that trade. The Murray trade was a bit of a disaster. They gave up 3 first-round picks, I believe, none of which have conveyed, I don't think. So they still owe those to the Spurs. But they didn't want to sit on their hands, and they just pulled off the Band-Aid, and they're going to reset with Trey and some of the other younger guys they have, which to me is the right move for this team. Switching gears a little bit to the Oklahoma City Thunder, who today agreed to a 3-year, $87 million contract with Isaiah Hartenstein and additionally traded for Alex Caruso a week or two ago before the NBA draft. So they are loading up. I think both of these are tremendous fits for this team. I mean, I have been on record saying that the Thunder desperately need to add a big man either during last season or at the very minimum in this offseason. And the roster is good enough around that they should be trying to contend as soon as this year. And Hartenstein is just an ideal fit because he's low maintenance. He's an extremely good defender and rim protector next to Chet Holmgren. He is a connector offensively, so he's going to fit right into the heavy ball movement and just everybody gets involved offense that the Thunder have. He's a very good passer in the short role. And probably most importantly is he is an elite rebounder, especially offensive rebounding. He was the second in the league last year in terms of offensive rebound percentage. And this is a team that was near the bottom of the league in rebounding. It was a clear flaw for them, and it got exposed in the postseason, just like many people thought it would. And so adding him to this group is just such a big add because it also gives them so many different lineup options. They can play Hartenstein when Chet is out of the game instead of having to go to a smaller guy like Jalen Williams every single time. That was basically what they had to do. They had no choice because they didn't have anybody of the size of Chet to come in when he wasn't in. They also can play Chet and Hartenstein together because Chet is good enough of a shooter and floor spacer to not clog the lane next to Hartenstein. And Hartenstein's also not really a guy that's going to clog the lane necessarily because he can do a little ball handling and passing up at the top of the key. He also is deadly in that little floater in the mid-range in the paint. And so I think that those two can thrive together. I think that they can be devastating defensively with those two in the paint. And then also they could still bring him off the bench and start Chet at the five like they did last year. So it gives them so much more flexibility in terms of their rotation and their lineups. When they play the bigger teams, they'll probably start Hartenstein. When they play some of the smaller teams, they might roll with Chet at the five and bring him off the bench. So all around, just great move for them. Definitely a steep price. I mean, 29-ish million a year is higher than I thought he was going to get. I thought he would have been more in the 22 to 25 range. But again, that's just where the NBA is today. Like, we just got to adjust because all the salaries are higher. And if you want to get a guy, you're going to have to pay him. And so they had the space to work with. They haven't really paid a bunch of guys on their team anyway. So it's not like it's detrimental. They're not going to like be a second apron team or anything like that. Plus, I think they said that the third year of his deal is non-guaranteed and it's a descending deal. So he will make less each year of the contract. So just crafty ad by Presti and goes right hand in hand with Alex Caruso, who is going to be a perfect fit on this team. I wrote an article about my thoughts on the Giddy and Caruso trade right after that trade went down. I was really speaking more from the Bulls side of things, and it was largely going against the perception that the Bulls got fleeced because a lot of people did kind of share that. I'm personally still very, very high on Josh Giddey. He's only 21 years old. He's a guy that could average 28-8 next year. His efficiency's gone up the past few seasons. Like, he's a guy that you legitimately can run an offense through, a guy that will thrive with the ball in his hands more in Chicago and could be a major stat stuffer, will help other guys on the team like Kobe White, Patrick Williams, Nikola Vucevic, other guys that need shots. He'll help them get their shots. And I think he's got all-star potential and upside to me still. I know he was terrible as a shooter in the postseason. I know he got played off the court. I know he wasn't a good fit on Oklahoma City, but he was being asked to play a role that he just wasn't suited to play. He's not a stand-in-the-corner three-point shooter, and he was relegated to basically being that with the Thunder just because of how much their timeline was expedited as a contender and how much of a jump that Jalen Williams made just this past season, how much of an impact player Chet Holmgren was basically immediately for this group. So those guys need the ball in their hands too, and you're obviously going to prioritize them having the ball because they're just right now better players than Giddey and players that fit better for this team. So it made sense they want to move on from Giddey, but to sit here and act like the Bulls got fleeced is ridiculous to me. He's much more valuable than a mid first round pick or something like that, because what do you want to get out of a mid first round pick? A guy that has the upside that Josh Giddey has. And so I thought Chicago did really good in that trade. But none of that takes away from the fact that this is still also a really good trade for Oklahoma City. I thought this was a tremendous win-win deal for both of these teams. And Caruso is just everything that you could want in the Giddey spot for this team. A guy who is a good shooter and can knock down from outside. A guy who can still handle the ball a little bit, who is a connector offensively and a good passer, and a guy that will play within the flow of the offense. A guy who can bring the ball up a little bit if he needs to, but could also play very well off ball. And a tremendous, tremendous defender. There might not be a better perimeter defender in the league than Alex Caruso. He is legitimately one of the best, and him with Lu Dort is going to be absolute hell for other teams when those guys share the court together. Then you throw in Jalen Williams, SGA, guys that are also really plus defenders. Then you've got Chet and Hartenstein on the back line. Like, they're going to be so elite defensively, just so hard to score on, and because of how there's just not a lot of teams that have the combination of rim protection and perimeter defense that this team has. Maybe Boston's the only one that you could compare them to, but they're going to be devastating on that end of the court. And Caruso also alleviates a ton of their issues on the offensive end, because now there's not a swing Josh Giddey shooting the ball at only 18% from the corner in the postseason against the Mavs problem. So instead, it's Caruso who can make a play and get to the basket, who also is very comfortable shooting that three. So to me, they are loading up. They, to me, look like the favorite in the West right now, because Denver took a little bit of a step back. I will get to that in a little bit later as well. But I just love what they've done. I think that Williams is going to continue to get better. I think Chet's going to continue to get better and could be an all-star level upside type guy as soon as next season, potentially. I think Caruso and Hartenstein are just like role players made from heaven for this team, and just really for any team. Anybody would want either of those guys. And then SGA, obviously, with him, they have the star top five bona fide all-NBA MVP candidate that they need to contend. And then Jalen Williams, you know, could be a 25-point-per-game scorer as soon as next year as well. So I love what the Thunder have done. I think that they are going to be a force to be reckoned with not only next year but in the coming years. And I would really love for them to do like a home run type trade for like a Lauri Markkanen, for example. I don't think that they're going to do it. I feel like Presti is a little bit too patient to pull off something like that when they've already acquired Caruso and Hartenstein. I think he's going to convince himself and the team and just the fans that those two ads were big enough to get them to where they want to go. But man, if they could package their, even if it's 6-7 picks, who cares? They've got so many of them. You got to go for it, if, in my opinion, with Lu Dort and another salary filler like Usman Dang for Markkanen. That would just be, they would put them over the top, and they'd be the clear-cut favorites in the West, in my opinion. As of right now, they are probably the favorites, but it's a lot less of a sure thing because, again, they still need Jalen Williams to be the clear number two on the team, if or Chet, if he can develop there. But right now, they are still lacking a little bit of the consistency as a second option next to SGA. But with Lauri Markkanen, that would be totally alleviated. But I doubt that's going to happen. I feel like Presti's going to wait this thing out one more year before making any massive, massive moves, because he probably thinks they're close enough as is. Next, we had Kentavious Caldwell-Pope signing with the Orlando Magic on a 3-year, $66 million contract to leave the Denver Nuggets. And he's the exact kind of skill set that the Magic needed. They had really struggled shooting the ball last season, and that was particularly apparent in the postseason last year when they just really couldn't hit a shot outside of Paolo Banchero. But Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is one of the best in the game in terms of catch and shoot. I mean, in 2020, he was 39% on catch and shoot threes. 2021, he was 42%. 2022, he was 42% again. 2023, he was 44%. And then last year, he was 40%. So a consistent 40% catch and shoot guy from outside. He's also a very, very plus defender. Him next to Jalen Suggs is going to be a really, really good defensive backcourt, one that's going to maybe not be quite as good as the Jrue Holiday, Derek White backcourt, but it'll be up there in terms of best defensive backcourts. Both guys were legitimately in contention for all defensive teams last year and have just proven over the span of their careers to be very, very solid on that end. So again, just great pickup for Orlando. I still think it doesn't necessarily move the needle a ton for them in the East. I personally think their biggest need for this team is more of a shot creator. I know someone who can make shots is going to help them a ton because they did genuinely need that. I mean, it's basically a huge upgrade over like a Gary Harris, for example. He is similar skill set to Gary Harris, but kind of better at everything basically. But I still think they need another shot creator. I don't think Suggs is really a true point guard. So I think another reliable ball handler, another guy that can go get a shot, because they're still going to be really, really reliant on Paolo to generate a ton of offense for them, both in the isolation as well as just getting looks for others. Franz Wagner was a little disappointing in the postseason last year, showed that he's not quite there as a number two option. I'm not sure he's ever going to get there. Just he's more of a Swiss Army knife, do-it-all type guy than a true number two option. And then outside of those guys, I mean, it's really all complementary pieces offensively. So I think that was the number one need. I still think they're so young that they don't necessarily need to rush this or force it or anything like that. They've got a ton of assets, both with all of their picks as well as some good young players, tradable contracts. So I think slow playing this is fine. I think KCP is a really good add just in terms of helping their shooting, but also as a locker room guy. Guy's got two championships in the last 4 or 5 years or so. And he was a reasonable price point for this team as well, who still now has some cap space to work with regardless, but good add for Orlando. But I really more want to talk about the Denver side of this, because this is now back-to-back off seasons in which they've lost a very, very key part of their rotation. Last year, they lost Bruce Brown on a deal to Indiana. This year, they lose Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Both of these guys coincidentally happen to basically play the same position as a shooting guard. So now they have a hole there. They're probably going to roll with Christian Brown as the two guard and try to see if some of their younger guys can take a bigger step up. But to me, it's kind of embarrassing what the Nuggets are doing, because they have Nikola Jokic, the best player in the world, a guy who's won 3 of the last 4 MVPs and the finals MVP just 1 year ago, and a roster that has proven that they are good enough to win a championship if you get enough pieces around Jokic and the rest of the core. And so this is now 2 straight years where they let guys walk on, like, are both of those price points a little high? Was Bruce Brown really worth $20 million? Maybe not. Was KCP going to be worth $22 million this year for 3 years when he's already into his early 30s? Maybe not. But the point is, they had their bird rights. They could have overpaid for these guys. It's not like it's going to affect their cap space situation. They were already not going to have cap space with they let them walk anyway. And so this is really clearly just about the tax for them. And so there's no reason to let these guys walk other than the tax. And maybe they want to avoid the second apron. I get it to an extent. But for a team like Denver that's got Jokic, it's really it becomes less understandable. Because look at Boston. They won a title. They are doubling down. They re-signed Derek White to an extension. They re-signed Drew Holiday during the season to an extension. They just signed Jaylen Brown last offseason to the Supermax. They're going to sign Jason Tatum, you would think, to the Supermax. They gave Porzingis a deal after they trade for him. Like, they doubled down and said, we're going to pay all our guys because we want to go for it in this window that we have. Denver is doing the opposite. They are letting players walk in hopes of backfilling them on cheap rookie players that are unproven, and that didn't work out for them last year. They were extremely thin come postseason time. They just didn't have their bench was terrible. After their top six guys, five or six guys, they just didn't really have any reliable players at any position off the bench. I mean, they already traded away Reggie Jackson in a salary dump. They are going to be reliant on Christian Brown and Julian Strother and Daron Holmes, their first round pick from this year. And that's basically their bench. They might add a veteran or two on the minimum deal because that's all they can sign guys to at this point. But we saw them do that with Justin Holiday last year. He was not particularly consistent. He was in and out of the rotation for them. They re-signed DeAndre Jordan, who is not a viable postseason option at this point in his career. And so it's just a shame to see a team with the best player in the world that has a legitimate shot to win the championship let players walk just because they don't want to be in the luxury tax or the apron. And if there's ever a time to pay the luxury tax, if there's ever a time to be okay going in the second apron, it's with the best player in the world on your team and with a group that you know is good enough around him. It's different when you like, if you had like LeBron in his early Cavs years, like, yeah, you got the best player in the world, but it's not a good roster around him. So were you really contender? It's hard to tell. We know they're a contender. They already won a championship. So to not try to maximize him and this group is just really disheartening and inexplicable. And I think it's undefendable because Denver got worse yesterday. They got worse when they lost Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. They were already not a high-volume three-point shooting team. And KCP was probably their highest-volume catch-and-shoot three-pointer. He was a key part of what they do offensively as a guy that's sitting ready to shoot the ball. And his replacement, Christian Brown, is not a good shooter. He's a good defender, and I'm sure he's going to be a fine piece of this rotation, but he is not a good shooter at this point in his career. And so the KCP shooting presence is going to be missed. And he's also a spectacular defender, the best guard defender they had on this team. And Denver doesn't seem to be willing to make big investments to this roster financially or by giving up draft capital, which they could do either of at this point. But I don't know. I don't think that they're going to be the favorites going in next year. Like I mentioned, I think OKC should be viewed as the favorite in the West. I think that Minnesota has every reason to believe that they can beat this team again next year because, as I said, Denver is a worse team than they were. And I think Minnesota got better with the addition of Rob Dillingham and the emergence of Anthony Edwards, who could potentially be even better next season. And so Denver might not even be a top two contender in the West next season. And that's not even to mention Dallas, who obviously made the finals this year and would probably have a really good shot at being Denver as well. So I still think Denver is really good. And a lot of that is just blind faith in Jokic. But it's tough, man. It's not very often you get a guy as good as Jokic in his prime on your team. And Denver might be botching it, is the point. Because they don't appear to want to maximize his prime. And the loss of KCP and Bruce Brown last year, it's just how many more guys do you have to lose before you realize that the roster around him is suddenly not that good, especially if Jamal Murray isn't playing at an all-NBA level like we saw him in last postseason look a little bit more human. And Michael Porter Jr. is an overpaid, glorified role player. Aaron Gordon is really good, but he's a limited offensive player at times. And the bench is just a bunch of unproven young players that we haven't seen anything out of to this point. Okay, switching gears a little bit now. We just had the news drop today that Klay Thompson appears to be prepared to sign a 3-year, $50 million deal with the Dallas Mavericks. The deal is not official yet because they have to work out a sign and trade with Golden State, which apparently the Golden State hasn't totally agreed to yet. But in this deal that's been proposed, Josh Green would be going to the Hornets as part of a three-team deal with some second rounders going back to Dallas. I assume they might ship some of those to Golden State in order to help them execute this deal as well. But I think this is a nice pickup for Dallas. I don't think it's a needle mover for me, at least. I think that their biggest weakness last year and what was exposed the most in the postseason was the lack of shot creation other than Kyrie and Luka. They were basically completely relying on those two guys to generate looks for them, whether it be in the isolation or creating shots for other guys. And outside of those two, there really was no offense for this team. And the reason they lost the finals was because of their offensive stagnation and inability to get good looks. And so Klay Thompson, while he is still a very good shooter overall and useful player in some aspects, he doesn't help that part of this offense. Like, he's just not a shot creator. Even in his prime, he wasn't much of one. But especially at this point in his career, he's not a guy that you want creating a ton of offense. He's more of a finisher in terms of just knocking down open looks that other guys generate, which he's going to get plenty of. And I'm sure he's going to do really well next to Kyrie and Luka in terms of knocking down shots, because that was an area that they struggled in, especially in the finals last year too. Derrick Jones Jr. couldn't make shots. PJ Washington wasn't making shots. Like, their role guys did struggle from outside, and Klay should be a little bit of an upgrade there. But I don't think it's a total needle mover, because I still think they could get stuck in the same situation in a tough playoff series where Luka and Kyrie are having to do too much and nobody else is able to generate good looks for the team. But he still gives them size. He gives them some needed shooting. I mean, he's immediately a better shooter than anybody else on the team outside of maybe Kyrie. And he's an upgrade over Tim Hardaway Jr. But Tim Hardaway Jr. was barely even in the rotation down the stretch of the postseason last year. And Klay is definitely a bit washed. I mean, I've been probably as big of a Klay hater as there could be over the past couple of years. I think since he came back from his injury, he is a total shell of himself. Anyone who still thinks he's like a high level, close to 20 point per game guy consistently on a good team just hasn't watched him recently. He's completely lost multiple steps defensively, going from an all defensive guy to now often a liability on that end. His shooting from the field overall has declined a good bit. His shooting from three is still pretty good overall, about 39% last year, but it's more inconsistent. I mean, we saw him go 0-for-10 in the play-in game last year. That was not some massive outlier. He had games like that all the time last year. And so he's not going to be anything more than a complimentary piece for this team, which is fine. The contract is reasonable. Less than $20 million per year for a guy of that skill set is not bad. I still think it is a good acquisition, a good addition. I don't know if they were going to get anybody better than him. And so I'm not knocking the addition. I just don't want to jump to any conclusions that this is going to make some massive difference for them. Because to me, I don't view them really any differently than I did before this move. I think that they were probably top four team in the West, and I think they're probably still a top four team in the West. But I don't think they're above Oklahoma City now that they've made their additions of Caruso and Hartenstein, plus just a year of experience under their belt with their young guys. I don't think they're above Denver at this point, even with Denver losing KCP. And, I mean, you'd probably have to put them above Minnesota just because they match up well with them after what we saw last year. But if Ant improves a little bit and Dillingham ends up being a like reliable scoring piece for that team, then they got a real shot to beat them next time, I would say. But they also added Najee Marshall and let Derrick Jones Jr. go, lost Josh Green, like I mentioned, and added Quentin Grimes for Tim Hardaway Jr. in a trade with the Pistons. So overall, they added Klay, Najee Marshall, and Quentin Grimes for Derrick Jones Jr. and Josh Green. I like Josh Green. I was not a believer that Derrick Jones Jr. was going to replicate his shooting performance of last year. I mean, he was still not a great shooter during the regular season last year, but had some hot streaks during the playoffs, but that clearly came to a screeching halt in the finals. So I don't mind them letting him walk. It seems like they just preferred Marshall over him because they got basically the same deal. I can't imagine that they couldn't have added $1 million extra per year to match the deal that the Clippers gave Derrick Jones Jr. But I like Marshall. I think he's probably not quite as good of a point of attack defender, but he's still a good defender, and he's a better shooter and a little better ball handler and passer than Jones is. So I don't mind that swap for them. I think it's mostly net even. Like I don't view it as really them any different. And Quentin Grimes in the Josh Green spot, also pretty similar players. Both a little undersized, not true point guards, but not really guys that you can throw on bigger wings, but decent defenders across the board, pretty good shooters overall, guys that play hard. So, again, I just think the Mavericks are basically the same as they were, even with the addition of Clay, but I do think that he is an upgrade over what they had, gives them a little bit more offensive upside as a shooter next to Luka and Kyrie, but I don't think that he is going to massively change what this team is, especially because they still lack a little bit of extra shot creation, which is going to make it more difficult for them to beat these highly skilled five-out offensive teams like OKC and Boston. On the Warriors side of this, losing Klay and waiving CP3 and not being able to get Paul George, it is not looking good for them. I don't blame them for moving on from Klay. As I said, I've been a Klay hater. I think he is a good change of scenery guy and will probably be better in Dallas than he was with the Warriors the past few years, because I think he's going to be more okay accepting a smaller role in a new team versus with the Warriors. There's always that weird like legacy of, okay, well, I was an all-star with the team, so he's got a little bit too much of a green light, takes some shots he probably shouldn't, and things along those lines. But they really struck out by not getting Paul George, which I know wasn't totally their fault because the Clippers just refused to deal him. But I don't know where they go from here, because they are not close to contending. They are not even close to being a surefire playoff team. And I'm not even sure that they're going to make the play-in next year, because the West is absolutely stacked. I mean, just going down the list in the conference, the clear top four, which I mentioned between Denver, Dallas, Minnesota, and OKC, then you've got returning playoff teams from last year that either return basically everybody from last year, or in some cases might have even improved in New Orleans, the Suns, and the Lakers. And then you've got Memphis, who should be much improved next year. I anticipate them being a playoff team, just bringing everybody back healthy and adding Ja Morant back for a full season. Obviously going to make a huge difference. Then you've got teams like Sacramento, who are looking to be aggressive, adding another score in either a Brandon Ingram or a Zach LaVine or something like that. Then you've got the Clippers, who at least are trying to go for it again. Then you've got the Spurs, who you can't totally rule out from being good next year just because of Wemby. I don't think they're going to make the playoffs, but would I be shocked if they snuck in the play-in? I wouldn't. And then you add in Houston as well, who showed real flashes of being a good team last year. They should continue to improve. Şengün should be back healthy. Jabari Smith showed some strides last year, and then Jalen Green looked like he was on his way to breaking out towards the end of the season. So if you add in Golden State, that is 13 teams in the Western Conference that theoretically will be either going for it or thinking they have a chance to at least make the play-in. Maybe not the playoffs, but the play-in. So would I be completely shocked if Golden State was at the 11 or 12 seed? I wouldn't, because like right now I'd have Memphis, Denver, Dallas, Minnesota, New Orleans, Oklahoma City, the Lakers, and the Suns clearly ahead of them. That's eight right there that I think there's really no discussion on if they're better than Golden State or not. Then you throw in the Kings and the Clippers, and I think those are two teams that probably are better than Golden State. I personally think they're probably better right now. Maybe not the Kings, but we'll see what they do. And then you throw in Houston, San Antonio, like I mentioned, and we'll see what happens with those teams. But the point is, I think they're looking at, on paper, probably like the 9th or 10th best team in the conference right now, with potential to be worse if some of these other younger teams have breakout seasons or something like that. So I don't know what their go for it is. The rumors are right now saying they're trying to trade for Lauri Markkanen. Maybe they will if Utah decides they want to go that route. But if they do that, would they make the playoffs? Maybe. It's really all I can say, maybe. But it's still no sure thing, especially with the uncertainty of a guy like Draymond. Steph has had some durability issues throughout the past couple seasons as well. And so it's a tough sell for the Warriors. And the thing is, they'd probably be best off blowing it up and trading Draymond and trading Steph and riding out Kuminga and Pajemski and Trayce Jackson-Davis and whoever they get back in some of these deals. But it's just such a delicate situation when you've got a guy like Draymond and Steph, especially Steph Curry. I cannot imagine them trading him unless he asked out, but he also doesn't really seem like the type that would ask out. So I don't know what their go for it is otherwise, but it could get kind of ugly if Draymond declines or blows up, or they do decide to maybe move him, and then it's just a bunch of younger guys that none of have like true all-star potential next to Steph in a stacked conference. You might just see them be one of those like late Lakers Kobe type endings to Steph's career, where they're kind of just a bad team sitting in not even mediocrity, just at the bottom of the conference with a generational all-time player in Steph that is just kind of there. And so we'll see what they do. But to me, blowing it up makes the most sense, but I just don't think that they'll do it because I think it'd be too hard of a pill to swallow for them to move on from Steph Curry. And then lastly, I just want to talk one last free agent signing that happened that I thought was worth talking about, and that is Chris Paul to the Spurs. I absolutely love this addition for both sides. Chris Paul might finally be admitting that he's probably not going to get a championship ring because I obviously don't see San Antonio winning anything this year. But when I talked about Wemby towards the end of last season, I talked about how good he was and how they needed to start making some meaningful additions around him. And maybe not star players, but at least competent players, players that can help maximize him. Put a like legitimate NBA roster around this guy, because outside of Devin Vassell, I don't really think there was a lot of players to write home about on San Antonio last season. And so I even mentioned Chris Paul as a guy that I thought could be a good fit. And I think he's going to do wonders for Wemby. He's probably not going to play 30-plus minutes a game, but they obviously won't need him to. But I just think the minutes with him and Wemby on the court together are going to be so much better. I guarantee Chris Paul's on-off stats next year are going to be tremendous because he's going to unlock so many things for Wemby. He just needs a guy to get him this ball in his spots and be able to throw some lobs and run some pick and roll and some pick and pops. And just it's the bare minimum here because they didn't have anything like that last year. Trey Jones helped a little bit there, but he's just not a threat offensively. He's just much more of a backup level player at this point. And Chris Paul might be close to that, but at least we know he is still very, very good at a few things, particularly running an offense, running a pick and roll, getting guys balls in their spots, and that's exactly what Wemby needs. So I love the pickup. It's a low-risk move for the Spurs, obviously a one-year deal. And like I said, would I be shocked if they snuck into the 10 seed? I really wouldn't, because I think Wemby could be a top 10 to 15 guy as soon as this season. And a huge part of that will be because I think Chris Paul is going to help unlock a lot of what he does on that end of the court. On top of just being a great locker room guy, a great leader, a winner, a guy that is just can show these guys the right way to do things on both ends of the court. And so I expect the Spurs to be pretty dramatically better from last year just because of Wemby's growth alone. But I also think, like I said, Chris Paul will help. I think that Stephon Castle could be a nice piece for them. And I also think that they probably will add a couple other players. At least I hope they do. And then maybe a year from now is when they really decide to go forward and make some more aggressive moves. But it was reported that they are also a team interested in Lauri Markkanen. So we'll see. If they pull off something like that, then they could be higher up the standings than people think as soon as this season. But still TBD on if they decide to be aggressive and pull something off like that. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I know there was a lot to cover and still some deals that we didn't even get to. D'Anthony Melton signed with the Warriors. DeLon Wright with the Bucks. Nick Batum is back with the Clippers. Derek Jones Jr. to the Clippers as well. Jalen Smith signed with the Bulls. The OKC re-signed Isaiah Joe and Aaron Wiggins. And probably most hilariously of all, Tobias Harris back with the Pistons. The Hall of Fame first ballot bag chaser in the NBA, Tobias Harris. And then, you know, quickly got re-signed Siakam, Claxton, Monk, extensions for guys like Scottie Barnes, Bam, etc. So a lot of other deals, but obviously going to be difficult to get to all of them. But tried to focus on the big ones. As more transactions come through, trades, signings, whatever it may be over the next week or so, I'll definitely hop back on and talk through those as they come through. But I think most of the bigger dominoes have already fallen at this point, so we'll see. But you never know. Sometimes we get some late summer trades action and whatnot. But with that said, thank you so much for listening, and I will chat with you soon.